Hello, this is Melissa. It is Real History, and today is Thursday, August the 15th, 2024, and I'm happy to be back with JP and Julie, and their podcast and work is under the name Book of Hours. So I had an issue with this recording, and what happened was that my voice all the way through had a lot of feedback and echo to the point that it was not listenable. And I believe that I isolated the issue, so hopefully that won't happen again. But what I had to do, because I had a nice long conversation with Julie and JP, and they had a lot of good things to say, I didn't want to lose that. So I've simply cut myself out and made a few notes where I recorded some segues, so it makes sense. So I put myself back in on a re-record, so it doesn't have the flow of the conversation that we had, but I do think that it will be more enjoyable on the ears than all that echo. I put up a couple of weeks ago Leela's Ocean, and this was the cyberbullying and ultimate suicide of a member of Julie's extended family.
That was a relative, that was someone in Julie's extended family.
Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Melissa. It's good to be with you again.
Yeah, it's been a while.
And I want to thank you for doing that piece about Leela Bradshaw. It's helpful. I think that story has gone out. I mean, it's now been covered by the Daily Mail, so that's a good thing. The message about cyberbullying is getting out there. So I appreciate you you covering it as well. So thank you for that.
It's been a while since we've talked to you, and I think that it's because we moved across country again. And so we've moved across country twice now in 5 years.
When
we last spoke to you, we were in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We now live in the Gulf Coast town of Biloxi, Mississippi. So we got back to the beach. I grew up in Southern California. Julie's from the San Francisco Bay Area. When we lived in San Francisco, we regularly would ride our bikes to the beach. And so we missed the ocean. And so we're glad to be back near a big body of water that's salty.
Yeah, it's been a really wonderful experience. Living in the South is totally different than living in the North, which is Pittsburgh, or even living on the West Coast.
Yeah.
We're both Californians, and it's similar. Like, the, you know, there's still this, like, really laid-back attitude in general, you know, when you live in a region where there's no snow.
Yeah, but I think that's the coastal influence as well, you know.
I was thinking about it. What's really interesting about Biloxi is, as you always remind me, is it was founded as an outpost of the French Empire, French Crown. So you're living in the state of Mississippi, which everybody has their idea of what the state of Mississippi is, right? I mean, everybody has this preconceived notion about it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, but then you're living on a coast, which is a completely different element. Coastal people, you know, like, nobody around here really has that Mississippi accent. A few people do here and there.
Yeah, but they have their own kind of accent.
Yeah, it's very musical. Then you've got the French influence on top of it. So there's a lot of little cafes and you know, buildings, just the way things are done here. Mardi Gras is huge here. So it's a totally different experience. It's very unique. I mean, just going 2 hours further inland, it's like a completely different environment,
and,
you know, different culture.
You go 90 minutes west, you're in New Orleans. You go about an hour east, and you're in Mobile.
Right.
And so those are both established French colonies as well. So, it's the Carnival and Mardi Gras are, like Julie said, they're huge here, and it's a whole culture.
Kids get a week off school
during Mardi Gras here in Biloxi.
Yeah.
And it's, it's a big social event, not just a party. You know, it's not just the day of.
No, it's a week.
Well, I know, but then there's the carnival season that ends at Epiphany, or begins at Epiphany and ends at Ash, you know, at Ash Wednesday, right? Or Mardi Gras, the day before Ash Wednesday. So it's a whole season, you know. It starts after Christmas. In fact, there's a ceremony downtown at Biloxi City Hall where they shift the lights that shine on City Hall from red and green to yellow, purple and green, right? So the Mardi Gras colors. And it's a big thing. It's called Twelfth Night. And we went to the Twelfth Night event this year. And it's fun. And it's fun here. It's fun in Biloxi. People like to have fun.
Yeah.
People enjoy themselves. You can take, you know, sometimes say, do you want that cocktail to go?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because, you know, we know that today's discussion is about the erosion of consciousness. And there's such a dichotomy of two worlds here. Like, we don't see a lot of people on their devices here. And the city and the community have constant things. There's just this constant rollout of things going on, you know, whether it's the Friday night bike ride, the second Saturday of the month where everybody goes, you know, gets out of their house and goes downtown and buys food and listens to music.
First Friday.
There's something called First Friday. Mm-hmm. There's water stuff, boats, you know, there's so many things to do here. Not a lot of people are on their devices.
And I never see the children, especially when they're waiting. Like, there's a kid that waits for the bus for school in the morning, and I see him. I've talked to him before. He never has a device. I don't think they allow – I haven't looked into it, but I don't think they allow them in the school here in Biloxi.
Right.
And I was just reading an article in the New York Times Morning Email. I look at that because of the propaganda. I'm always looking for their propaganda and their slant on things. Anyway, so I was reading that morning email, and they were talking about how schools across the country are starting to bring in, like they're saying, you can't bring your phone to school, or they you can't have it on, you know, so you have to check it either at your locker, or, you know, you can't bring it to school at all. So that's a good thing. I think that's a very, you know, positive thing. And I think that the kids here, we see them, like the same kid that I see waiting for the bus. He and his brothers go down to the park down here. I mean, we're about a block away from, maybe two blocks from a park that we can actually see. It has swing sets, it has basketball courts, tennis courts.
Yeah.
We were told that in the years gone by, there was actually a pool there at one point too. Mm-hmm. So, but the point is that I'm trying to make is we have, you know, parks for the kids to play in. It's a small town. And it has that kind of, it's kind of weird because it's not urban, but it is in some ways. And it's not suburban, but it is in some ways. And I think that's just the fact that it's a coastal town.
Right.
And
it's a coastal town. I mean, it's definitely a vacation spot.
Yeah.
And we're used to living in a tourist city, being in San Francisco.
And growing, I grew up in Southern California.
Lots of tourists come here to stay at the resorts and all that.
I lived near Disneyland, so I'm used to tourists and the beach. And so you see that along coastal regions where people are a lot more relaxed. And so, and you know the area. You said that when in our conversations in the past along, you know, offline, you've visited Biloxi before, correct?
Mm-hmm. I was saying that I had driven through that area with a cousin. My mother was from the northern panhandle of Florida, and everyone on her side of the family lives between Louisiana and Florida. So welcome to the South.
That's our opinion of the Gold Coast. Thank you for asking. That was a very long answer to your question.
We had some, I don't know how to transition here.
The erosion of consciousness.
Yeah. And we are, you know, JP and I, we're not going to sit here and get into some woo stuff about it. Where we're not going to go deep. We're going to look at it from a propaganda perspective. Mm-hmm. But when I think of the erosion of consciousness, I think of the actual loss of consciousness of a human being, like somebody who goes into the ER and suddenly they faint, you know, and so they're in that suspended state where they don't have any idea what's going on. They're completely separated from their reality and from the world around them. So it's also known as syncope, or fainting, or passing out a brief period of time. When someone loses consciousness and muscle strength, it's usually caused by a sudden decrease in blood flow to the brain, and it's almost as if users are passing out or fainting and in this continued state of the loss of consciousness. And even though they claim to be awake, like you have a lot of people that are awake to what's going on in the world, you know, whether it's the COVID project or the 9/11 project, you know, people seem to be awake to things like the deep state, and they claim to be awake, and they're all over social media claiming how awake they are, but they've forgotten what being in a waking state actually is. They're so influenced by their influencers mm-hmm. or their favorite podcasters, and in the corporate world, they yeah. eat their own dog food.
Right.
You know, or to use a corporate phrase,
yeah.
they're eating their own dog food. So it's like, and there's all sorts of reasons for that, and it's really not their fault because of AI mm-hmm. and media and social media manipulation. I mean, I recently put something up on social media that said there are three individuals on the planet that control free speech or, you know, the First Amendment or free speech for billions of people online. And that's Elon Musk because of X. That's, I think it's Sundar Pichai because of
Google
and YouTube and ABC. And then it's Mark Zuckerberg because of Meta, Facebook, and Instagram. So these are three individuals that have the power to take down your thoughts, your emotions, your posts, your art, your opinions. And to me, that's really discomforting. Like, I hate the idea that there's three people that have that much power over billions of users, and the users forget that.
Well, I think also you they know? Can collect all that, too, and use it.
Sure, and they weaponize it against you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you've been using a phrase lately, Julie, that I think applies, too, is that they've lost the plot.
A lot of people have lost the plot. I have a couple friends who left social media altogether. They have no social media footprint at all. They've erased everything. They're not on Twitter. They're not on Facebook. They're not on Instagram. And everything that they do in their life is just their real world connections. It's easy. In one case, it's easy for one of our friends to do that because she grew up in the same place, practically in the same neighborhood, from like age 4 to age, you know, 48 or 49, whatever she is. So she's lucky that she's got decades of people that she grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
But not everybody has that. Like, we don't.
We don't,
you know. So our connections are online, but it's difficult because when you have your own ideas and opinions about things and you haven't lost the plot, which I like to think I haven't, but I realize that I probably have in some ways. And you're talking to someone who claims that they're awake, but they're not. So it's very so it feels like an erosion of consciousness. It feels like an erosion of even being conscientious.
Right.
You know?
And I think that a lot of this has been happening at least as long as since World War II. It's probably been going on longer than that. At least since you know, mass media has been around. You know, newspapers allowed for slower news cycles, and they got the word out, but it took longer for information to get from one person to the next. With radio and subsequently television, news became faster, and information became more available more quickly. And, you know, there's a reason in the 1950s they called it the boob tube, right? Because it was, you know, for boobs, as they called it, but like it also, you know, there was that book by Harlan Ellison called The Glass Teeth, you know, and so it started influencing people a great deal. And since World War II, you know, we've seen a lot of this going on. And one of the things that I came up with the other day, and I think I'd like to get back to it, but I'll just say one of the things I've been thinking about lately is that our life has been, we're not living in a simulation. There's a lot of people that are saying we're living in a simulation. And I feel that what we're living is more of a curation. Mm-hmm. But I want to come back to that because mm-hmm. there's some things that I think that make up what we're talking about and what we're going through. And so one of the main things that we're seeing is authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to talk
sure.
to that?
I'll speak to that a little bit. So we learned through the COVID operation that we live in a rules-based society now. And if anybody's out there reading Catherine Watt, she talks about how the Constitution has been suspended for decades.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
we're basically living in a rules-based society, not a society based on law or constitutional rights or even human rights. Mm-hmm. It's based on mm-hmm. rules. And you saw this today when the European Commission, I believe, and mm-hmm. Came out, and every mainstream news source, every global news source covered it today, August 12th, because they announced to Elon Musk, be careful what you say. You can't violate this new digital act. I forget what it's called, but it's the some sort of digital
right.
act.
So
yeah.
So the European Union, yeah.
Yeah. And the reason they said this is because he's hosting Donald Trump on his platform in a few hours today.
From the time that we're talking, yeah.
Yeah,
yes.
from the time
yes.
we're talking. So I'm like, that's so authoritarian. Like, to come right out and say, be careful what you say, be careful how you say it. You know, 1/3 of your users are, in Europe, and we don't want them to be incited to violence or wrongthink. And so there's this weird authoritarian rules-based society that we live in. Kamala Harris recently came out and said she wants to get rid of big government. Under her administration, you will have less big government. And everybody's like, yay, less big government, because they think maybe, they won't have to pay taxes or something like that. When really what she's talking about is a leap right into global governance.
Right.
Which again is a rules-based society. It's very boring, but it's also very authoritarian. And we saw that with COVID or the COVID operation, where it was the equivalent of putting like a memo on a post in the public square that said, everybody needs to stay inside because the health czar or the health secretary said so, and nobody questions it. So that's another problem with this erosion of consciousness. And so what happens is you have these users that are really frustrated in the real world, and so they transition all their frustration online, which then is used to weaponize them. So their own feelings, which are natural. Naturally, you're unhappy with your rights being taken away and eroded. That's a natural place to be. But then that natural feeling that all humans would have when they're witnessing the erosion of their life is weaponized against you. So it's challenging. Social media, I think, is absolutely contributing to, again, we just talked about cyberbullying and this extended family member of mine that took her own life. Social media contributed largely to that after years and years of being bullied and harassed. The rise of suicides in children is like, we've never seen this before. You certainly didn't see it in my generation, mm-hmm. Generation X.
Bullying meant something else.
Yeah,
right?
it was
physical.
Yeah, and you could fight back. And you can't fight back against a person who's hiding behind a screen and gossiping about you and getting their minions, their digital minions, to attack you. Mm-hmm. It's happened to us, and it was so traumatizing to us. We did this breakout video a few years ago called Communitarianism, and we were digitally attacked, like viciously, viciously attacked over it. And as full-grown adults, we were shook. We were affected by this. So I can't even imagine what children.
The other thing that I've learned is that they have bot farms that are set up to attack you if you are saying something that they don't like. There's what you're saying about a rules-based society where you don't even know what the rules are. So these attacks feel very personal, and they are, in a sense, but sometimes they're orchestrated in a very impersonal way.
The weird thing about the rules-based society, though, is that they don't necessarily give you what the rules are.
No.
They withhold those rules. And like, for instance, you know, with this European Commission, you were reading to me some of the stuff, and I'm like, you know, raising all these questions. Obviously, I wasn't asking Julie those questions. I was just like, well, who says what is what? And where is that list of keywords that they're referring to?
Oh, right. They say they're going to farm keywords. Mm-hmm. They're going to look for keywords and hashtags. In the Trump speech, it's like, well, what keywords and what hashtags are you looking for? It's almost like they're setting you up to fail.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
so
it's
become more and more clear to me that the digital realm, which you've got the Elon Musks out there and all of his acolytes talking about how it's the new town square. It is not.
No.
It is not. It is a place where people go and whatever it is that they're thinking or tweeting or saying or posting is absolutely going to be weaponized against them. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's why you have so many people leaving the digital plantation.
There was the recent incident in the UK where these Taylor Swift fans were stabbed to death. This is the story that we've heard. And the men who were responding with a lot of emotion to this story and were said to be inciting hate, they were tried and imprisoned within days of this.
Exactly. It was Tyler, and I forget the other guy's name. I wrote it down. But yes, very quickly. But see, first of all, how real are these stories?
Exactly.
Okay. So we have to take everything with a grain of salt. Yeah. To me, the more salacious and more insane they are, the less I believe that.
And the less you can verify them.
Yes.
Right.
It means that there's probably less truth to them. Yeah, well, right. And here's the other thing. Originally, you know, a lot of these attacks were through guns. Right now they're going beyond that. They're trying to make it so that, you know, like, well, maybe people shouldn't just get together at all because who knows, somebody might have a knife too.
Well, okay, and every time I turn around, there's yet another story about somebody wielding a machete in San Francisco.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Yet another person with a machete was found in San Francisco. Come on.
Yeah, those are easy to hide.
But regarding what you said about the two gentlemen in the UK, so this is what's happening on social media. You've got Americans that are very, very upset. One guy's name was Jordan Parler, and the other guy's name was Tyler Kay. I think those are the two gentlemen you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they're really upset about the fact that these two guys are just arrested and then thrown in jail. Practically no due process, no charges, just immediately just assumed something and then thrown in jail. Well, the same thing happened in the United States, at least this is the story we're told. I like to kind of, JP and I have learned how to kind of
phrase these things. Yeah.
Phrase these things and doctor up our language. The story we are told is that hundreds of people were thrown into jail without due process, without any official charges against them for going to the Capitol for January 6th. And that in some cases, some of them were even tortured through isolation. They were put in isolation for half of that time. So this goes all the way back to 2021.
Yes.
We're now in 2024. I see so many American users really upset about this UK thing, this story about, you know, the UK government coming out and saying you will be prosecuted if you say something or tweet something or post something. You will.
Yeah.
They're so upset about it. But I'm thinking, well, what about your own, the story about your own citizen?
Yes.
So this is what I'm talking about, the erosion of consciousness. You've got something right in front of you that is happening on your own soil, but there's so much emotion and so much reaction to this UK story that it's almost as if they're living in that like when we started this conversation and I talked about what it means to be, to lose your, to lose consciousness, you're in that sort of suspended state. And they're living in this suspended state where they've forgotten that there's hundreds of people sitting in cages right now for taking a walk. You know, at least that's the story we're told.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's like, if you want to talk about loss of rights and loss of life, maybe you should look in your own backyard.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I mean, even in McKees Rocks, where we lived in Pennsylvania, our neighbors told us stories about how they would be, you know, sitting on their porch or just walking home from the market, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, cops, Pittsburgh cops, Allegheny County cops, McKees Rocks cops would descend on people that were just walking, grab them, rough them up, and throw them in the back of a police car and disappear them. And they weren't even doing anything.
Yeah. There was this period of time when just being out on the street was like, they were trying to prevent crime, so they just made crime everything is a crime.
So if you recall, Bloomberg had the stop and frisk rule in New York, and I think it was a carryover from that. And eventually there had to be like a huge outcry for them to stop this behavior. So, you know, it's really sad about what's going on in the UK. But I mean,
well, and then, you know, then as you,
what about
like,
here?
What about here? And then there's a lot of things that people are not talking about that are, and we always come back to, you know, pay attention to the mundane, pay attention to the boring, because that's the shit that's going to kick you in the ass. Not the big, huge, events that are there to distract you that are horrific, but are probably only partly true. And, you know, Julie's been saying, you know, your life from now on is going to be a series of 9/11 moments.
Little
9/11 moments.
Where you have little box checkers and little clipboard holders and corporate, you know, just very, like, you know. You saw this with the COVID operation when parents would go to school board meetings and shake their fist in front of the either the city council or the school board and say, how dare you put a mask on my child or enforce these policies. And the administrative people that basically have like sociology degrees would just sit there and go, oh, okay, thank you for your time. You know, to me, that's your 9/11 moment. You've lost the plot. You know, there's something else going on and so people think that by reacting in a very visceral way or reacting in a very highly emotional way, that it's going to make a difference. And it won't.
No.
The best way is to just stop.
This touches on something that Alan Watt would always say, we can't know what happened unless we were there. And even if we witnessed something, we may still have questions. And he did not like to see particularly young men falling victim to this kind of thing where your emotions are whipped up. They are first victims to their emotions, and then they're victim to the system which has flooded their country and their area with too much immigration that can't be absorbed. And the same system that sets these events up or that capitalizes on these events to ends which suit them.
They took the bait.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned something, you know, like it's, you know, the law-based society has gone away, and it's like we said before, it's a rules-based society, and you don't have to know, you don't have to tell us we don't have to tell you what the rules are. Basically, we just make them up as we go along, and if we have made them up before, we're not going to tell you what they are. You're going to have to guess. And if you get into trouble, that's your problem, right? It kind of reminds me of that bit from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy from many years ago, where they were like, they were coming to destroy the planet Earth, and they said, well, you had you know, so many decades to read the plan, and it was posted on at Alpha Centauri for, you know, right. you know, 100 years or whatever, right? And so, you know, you're basically saying, well, you know, it was there. Mm-hmm. Too bad you couldn't get there to read it, but, you know, right. we did make the rules.
Meanwhile, exactly, and I just want to say that it, what you were just saying mm-hmm. reminds me of something that Shoshana Zuboff said a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know who she is.
Asset.
Yeah,
asset.
Surveillance capitalism, total asset. But she did make a point about something that stuck with me, and that is, you know, when we were colonizing, you know, this country, treaties were handed over to the native population. And, you know, it was like they just put an X at the bottom of the treaty, and they had no idea what the treaty said. Mm-hmm. And that's how I feel we're being governed, is through these treaties that right. we're incapable of
understanding.
Of understanding them. There's nobody there to translate what these rules are in this rules-based society. They make it up as they go along. They change, they flip-flop, they go back and forth. You're seeing, and that contributes to a lot of chaos in your mind, and chaos and anxiety in your mind contribute to the erosion of your instinct, your pineal gland, all the things you need for self-governance, autonomy of thought. There's this term, critically thinking. I prefer autonomous thinking, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, and all this is a very corporate thing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've worked in corporations and you existed in that world, like Julie and I have, and I still currently do, the only thing that saved me and has kept me working, you know, in that position or as in the job that I have, not that I like being working for a corporation, but it, you know, pays pretty good. But the only reason that, not a lot, but, you know, it's better than driving school bus that I did before.
It's better, yeah.
At least pay-wise. I had a lot more freedom driving a school bus.
That's true.
But my point is that the only, you know, like the fact that I work from home now is makes a big difference in my surviving and being able to deal with corporate society and corporate rules and the corporate world, because it's so restrictive, it's so difficult, and it's so, you know, the groupthink is just so difficult, and people, because they don't realize that they're in a highly stressful environment, they think it's just normal, but they start acting out, and they start acting out by scapegoating and attacking people that they feel are weaker, you know, and I find that a lot less prominent in remote work than I ever did when I was working on site.
Right.
That's kind of the opposite of what people are finding on social media. But in this case, there is some sort of governance, at least with like the corporate world. There's always like, well, you know, you can't attack people for no reason, at least.
There is no anonymity in the corporate world, but there is anonymity in social media. So that's one reason why you see so much of this in social media.
Exactly.
So really good point.
You know,
thank you.
Even though it is possible to go after people, you know, I still have been scapegoated.
But as a designer, as a UX designer, you have, and as a designer in general, I mean, design our home, you designed the yard. I mean, he's a master gardener. And
well, not officially a master gardener.
He's a master at gardening.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And he's a painter, so he pretty much, together we designed the house, you know, but, so, talk about this curation of society.
Yeah.
How society is curated. Yeah. I mean, there's the class structure that's curated.
Mm-hmm. Well, so when I was thinking about this the other day, you know, it's, I was thinking about, like, you know, there's been certain people that you listen to been saying, oh, we're living in a simulation, or it's living in a simulation. And I'm thinking to myself, no, we're not living in a simulation. What we're living in is curation, which is what I mentioned before. And by that, I mean that all aspects of our life have been curated through consumerism or through culture. And it doesn't matter if it's pop culture or high culture or whatever it might be. Your particular interests and who you are, and like I said, especially since World War II, because mass media allows for that curation and that outreach, marketing research and media research have all been able to find personality types and create profiles on individuals and people. And through these profiles, they've been able to curate to you the type of media that you might want to appreciate or the type of lifestyle that you embrace. And I'm thinking, first of all, like, you know, so we're talking about post-war culture, and especially in pop culture, you know, they talked about post-war youth culture, right? And so this whole idea of, you know, there were, you know, movies with motorcycle gangs and you know, motorcycle kids and hoods and, you know, that whole fabrication of the movie Grease was based on all that idea. You know, you had the beach, you know, you had Annette Funicello and I forget his name, Frankie Avalon you know, and the beach blanket bingo, and, you know, you had beatniks and you had, you know, beach bunnies and you had the bikers and they all kind of mingled on the beach and, you know, we're out there having fun in the warm California sun and, you know, so rock and roll and all these things developed out of that. I mean, these were cultures that probably were organic, but then were taken, modified, and curated and spit back out into popular culture so that people who would fit into certain categories that they knew existed psychologically, they could curate messages to. But, you know, you also look at, like, then further on, you look at, like, the testing that we all used to have to take where we'd fill in the little bubbles, you know, on the test. So that you'd read the question and then you had a card and you filled out, like, the little bubble for the answer, you know, with a number two pencil. Because it had to be a number two pencil. Because, you know, if you had a number three pencil, I don't know.
Rebel.
I know. So, you know, these things then start placing people into tracks of, like, you know, what kind of job you're going to do, what kind of person you're going to be. You know, one of the other things that that I was thinking about this morning, you know, about this talk that we're you know, this conversation we're having, something else occurred to me that from, like, years ago, I remember, it's called the VALS, it's called Values and Lifestyles, and marketing companies, and I think it was developed in Stanford, marketing companies have used this over the years. I think it's been kind of modified, and, you know, and it's like they organize people into, like, innovators and survivors, and then, like, through ideals, achievements, self-expression, you have the experiential person who's out there. It's all about self-expression. They might be outdoorsy, so you market them a Jeep, and you market them certain clothing brands and certain clothing styles. There's people. This is new. I'm looking at this graphic, the VALS framework. Just, you know, look up VALS and you'll see it, the values and lifestyles. They have a maker, they have a striver, they have a believer, the achiever, and the thinker. And so these are, like, ideals, achievement, self-expression. And so all of these things are sort of the starting block, or the modules, if you will, that they use to kind of start putting people into for these profiles that they create in order to market lifestyles to you, or they use to, like I said, like, tracks that they put you in for your educational career as well as then your work career. We did a video a while ago about schools. It was during the whole Corona project, the education, and how we were saying, you know, this is sort of the end of education as we know it. Through our research, we found that you know, through various programs and various means, that, you know, children get, you know, tested, they get categorized and put into tracks where they might go into the school to prison complex or pipeline. They might get sent to the corporate pipeline. They might be workers and not managers, and then other people are going to be managers and so forth. So at the same time, though, then, you know, the type of education that you get, depending on whether you were born to a family where you have a mom and dad, or you're a single mother, and you get, you know, Julia's talked about this, how she feels like she was identified as a particular type of person. Yeah, lifelong learning was the video. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that she was identified as a child of a single mother, and that because of that, she was more vulnerable to attack through the medical complex or through, you know, government interference or what have you. Okay. And then I grew up in a nuclear family, and it was very middle class, but we were, you know, lower middle class, you know, we were working class moving into the lower middle class. And I was only fed certain things. And one thing that I go back to, and I'm going on and on and on, but I remember my school counselor in high school, I was getting pretty good grades. I was never a grade person. I was always like, you know, I've always been smart, but I never got good grades. That said, I was still in the advanced placement classes in high school. But my counselor told me that I probably shouldn't try to go to the local state university. Why did she do that? I have a feeling that I had been flagged somehow through all the testing scores, through all the profiles that had been made on people like me, that I was destined to be a working class stiff of some sort, that I wasn't supposed to go to college. And it's weird because at first I got a letter from, it was Long Beach State University, and they had rejected me. Then at the end of summer, I got a letter saying, you know, we're ready for you. Come on and register and come in, and we'll be ready for you for this, you know, this fall semester. So this is the summer after I graduated high school. So at the beginning of the summer, or like right after I graduated, I got a rejection letter, but then I got an acceptance letter. So something weird was going on, I feel like my high school counselor was in on it, but I wasn't. I ended up going to community college, dropping out. But then when I moved to San Francisco, I went on to State University, San Francisco State University, and graduated. And graduated with high marks. I guess the point is that I took the side door. I decided that, you know, fuck the system that they're trying to put me into. I didn't outright recognize what was going on, but I felt it. And I think a lot of people feel it. They just don't know what it is. And so a lot of people talk about, like, oh, we're in the Matrix, and they think of the movie. But I don't think the Matrix is like the movie. I think the Matrix is a spreadsheet of data points that basically keep track of you through these profiles and these testing results and all these other things that keep you in your particular track within society. And right. Social media hasn't helped that at all.
Right. No. Exactly.
No. Yes, I said recently that I tested for journalism. That's what I was told to go and do, and to the point that I even edited my high school newspaper when I was a senior in high school because they said that's what I needed to do. But this, I think, goes back to the Industrial Revolution, this kind of standardizing of education. The Industrial Revolution, they needed people educated, just enough education so they don't cut their hand off in a big machine, but no more, certainly not enough education so that you're equipped to think for yourself. Alan used to point out that they'd give you the penny novels to keep you occupied. You know, you'd work a 16-hour day, and then if you were able to read, you'd have these kind of serialized novels that would keep you busy. And I was just doing, I think I had mentioned to Julie in an email, the real history that I did with Andrea called Art, Evil, and the Divine. And Andrea was talking about the trend in UK schools to defund art. And this is actually happening in the US too. But in the UK, they're, you know, they have an advertising campaign saying
your children are going to be working in the metaverse, and they're getting a lot of educational programs in the UK training students how to participate in the metaverse. So standardization is a big thing.
Yeah, and I often go back to the first industrial revolution, like you just mentioned, because it is the start, it is the end of you know, thousands of years. I was trying to use a big word, that $10 word. Thousands of years of culture, agrarian culture, right, ending, and or the beginning of the end of that, and industrial culture coming along, and people having to become enculturated to the clock and time and linear time, not cyclical time, and conforming to, you know, the rules of the factory and the rules of, you know, being a wage slave. And I often talk about how I feel like the Civil War was that well, I can go into that later, but that it was a point in which, you know, slavery ended, or chattel slavery ended, only to be replaced by wage slavery. And I have a much richer and deeper thought about that I don't have time to go into right now. But we've been convinced that we have to be productive, that productivist thinking has prevailed, and that, like, you can't exist without a job, because you have to work in order to be somebody who's a contributor to society. Whereas, you know, before, it wasn't about that. You worked because you just, you know, you had to eat, or you worked, and leisure, and even the word leisure has been taken away from us and turned into something it wasn't meant to be. Where, you know, you had cycles where you worked and then you didn't work, and the time you didn't work was for celebration or spirituality or, you know, having fun at night, whatever that might be. I remember hearing about a time before electricity when night was basically when you went to bed, and you didn't necessarily sleep for that entire 12 or 14 hours. You would be up doing other things. You'd sleep, and then you'd wake up and you'd meditate, or you'd pray, or you'd have sex, or you'd, you know, whatever. In that, you know, it was just another cycle in life. And depending on where you lived in the world, north or south, you know, the time of year determined how much dark time there was, right? Something else that we came across recently, and Julie did a reading on her Friday readings, by a guy named W.D. James, and it's about, he calls it Chronopolitics, and it's a multi-part series on the idea of work and on leisure and what that means, and how work and leisure have been taken away from us and turned into something that is used against us. And we're working for wages and not for ourselves. And even when, you know, we were an agrarian society, we were feeding ourselves and we were maybe selling, you know, whatever was left over. However it worked, it was a different way of living. And I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to think romantically about this. I want to, you know, think about this in a more clear way, that, you know, I don't want to say, oh, it was always better back then, because I know it wasn't always better back then. But what I am saying is that the idea of our time was different than it is today. Mm-hmm. We're on a hyper clock. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, the first industrial revolution was about, you know, clock and mechanical time. And I've even heard people say, you know, well, your brain is a machine. Well, it's not a machine. It's not that. It's something else. And it's organic. And it has more to it than just a mechanism. But I want to get back to something. Sorry, Julie. I want to get back to, I know, I'm taking it all. And I'll hand it over to you in a second here. But I want to get back to what I was talking about, you know, how we're being programmed. Let me just hit the high points here, and because Julie wanted to make a good point here. So curation, hypernormalization, so authoritarianism, curation, hypernormalization, hoaxes and lies, and AI. A lot of this, you know, is coming together in the AI world. It's a curation of ideas, hypernormalization, and hoaxes. These are all easy to throw out to us or push out to us. This gets back into what we were talking about where, you know, vegetarian diet or an event takes place like a shooting or a knifing or something, and the reactions that take place as a result of that. All of that gets pushed out to you, you know, using these techniques, but AI is able to do it even quicker. So it takes, and by hypernormalization, what I mean is two ideas being pushed out to you that are opposite of each other. You would think that they would cancel each other out, but two opposite ideas or things are being pushed out to you at the same time by the same apparatus of the state. And so, you know, you start losing your sense of like who you are or what you stand for, and you just start getting into ideology rather than other things. A lot of this is being pushed to us through military action. And Julie was talking to me about this earlier. You know, did you want to illustrate that? I know I've been dominating the microphone.
That's okay. It's pretty simple. Trump pulled us out of Afghanistan, right? During the Trump administration, that was his claim to fame, that the military had left Afghanistan,
right? Yeah.
That was, and everybody was celebrating.
Well, actually, he
tried.
He tried, and then it did happen, and yeah, I mean,
and then,
Yeah.
But the point is that the military has been redirected, and its focus now is with behavioral modification and also health and human services. If your listeners don't know, the most powerful person in the United States right now is Javier Becerra. He is the Department of Health and Human Services Secretary. He's the Secretary of Health. He has more power in the palm of his hand than the President of the United States. The entire military apparatus, at least for the United States, has gone into biotech, the health industry. You've got a recent contract. In a press release on Thursday, Palantir and Microsoft announced an expansion of their existing partnership to bring some of the most sophisticated and secure cloud AI and analytics capabilities to the U.S. defense and intelligence community. You can't have a conscience, you can't have consciousness when your entire system, especially online, especially in the digital age, is controlled by the military. Mm-hmm. If you go back to the first Gulf War, you had something called Gulf War Syndrome. And I'm talking about the first Bush administration,
right,
from the, what was it, like late 80s,
yeah,
early 90s,
uh-huh,
where servicemen were deployed to the Gulf War and something happened in the Gulf War where they were talking about how they were losing their minds. They were, mm-hmm, seeing, mm-hmm, things that weren't there. They were behaving in ways that were erratic. And it turns out that basically all of these military men were deployed to this area and experimented on. That's what it came down to, is that there was all of this, you know, electromagnetic frequencies going on, and it was like a bloodbath of their minds, and they came back all screwed up. And so, of course, you know, the mainstream media said, oh, it's just Gulf War Syndrome, you know, because they were out of their elements.
Or
and,
they
you
were
know,
poisoned with
or,
something.
Or they were poisoned with something, and it was the enemy doing it. But really, it was the military running vast experiments on its own people. And so I think that's what's happening right now in this digital realm. You've got people saying things like, turn off your phones at night, get it away from your nightstand. And we all have our phones right next to us all the time. And I think that contributes to some of this loss of consciousness. I mean, I literally think that we're being experimented on through EMF poisoning, through digital, obviously through the geoengineering and things, mm-hmm, like that are going on in the skies. So, you can't, it's really challenging to have a conversation with anyone, especially in the digital realm. In the real world, it's a lot easier because you keep it superficial. Well, how's business? How's life? How's the family? You know, you keep it superficial. But in the digital age, when you're trying to get to the bottom of things and you're running down your rabbit holes and trying to figure out who the bad guys are and how to circumvent everything, you're being experimented on, in my opinion. So the military programming, I mean, I think that Elon Musk is part of the military in some way. You know?
Oh, yeah. Musk is definitely part of the military establishment.
Nobody's a hero here. And that's one thing that we say all the time is
no heroes.
No heroes.
Yeah,
for Right.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
We have to remember that Elon Musk's background, his maternal grandfather was either number one or two in Canada's Technocracy Inc. Musk is a perfect example of a technocrat.
Also, when you've got stories, like specific stories that come out, so I'll use a specific story that has come out regarding, you know, and the military is involved in somehow. I try not to look at the details of the story. I try to break away from all of the actual details of the story. So so here's the details. Tulsi Gabbard was put on a no-fly list through the TSA, through the Quiet Skies program. And as a result, the ACLU is filing a lawsuit against the Biden administration for her loss of constitutional rights. She didn't know she was... Did I say she's not on a no-fly list? She's on a watch list, which is a violation of her rights. So
right.
She can still fly.
She can fly, but she's, like,
but she's
being
highly monitored.
Right.
Okay, so let's take away all the details. This is an exercise in how to not lose your consciousness around what's happening. So the detail, those are the specific details. Well, who is Tulsi? She's embedded in the political world, a representative, a Bernie-crat, ran for office a couple of times, might even be running for office now, I don't know, but she's a political insider.
Political, yeah.
So
and
she is, right?
Yes, Tulsi's also in the military. She's active duty in the military.
So this is my second point. So we've got a political person in the military being targeted by a program that is part of the Department of Defense, the Department of, the TSA, which is part of the Department of Defense. So why do you have... Homeland Security. So why would you have Homeland Security monitoring one of its own? Like, why would you have that? Unless there's been some sort of an assembling or breaking away of some departments. You see what I'm saying?
A fissure or a fight within.
Something is going on.
Possibly. Or remember Orwell's 1984. The proles don't count. Who do they monitor in 1984? Their own bureaucratic class or their own assets. I mean, in with technology the way it is, yes, we are all being monitored. Let's not kid ourselves. But the heavy scrutiny is definitely for those people who are in, you know, they're workers.
Exactly. So we think of, you know, we think that all of these agencies and the military, we think that they're all sort of on the same side, like us against them, right? But actually, I think that there's some sort of erosion of our internal government workings. Like, I think that if you've got the Department of Homeland Security putting someone in the military on a watch list, why is the Department of Homeland Security putting the military on a watch list?
Well, not only that, but like somebody from Congress too. So you have a congressional member with an active military, CV, who's being put on a watch list, right?
Right. So does that mean that our government and our Department of Homeland Security has been compromised in some way? Does it mean our military has been compromised?
Or is this just a narrative that's being spun out in front of us?
Right. Like, why? Because, you know what I'm saying? Like, I feel that, Okay, well, let's pause and let's talk about TikTok, which is basically digital fentanyl. TikTok is run by, you know, a Chinese company called ByteDance, okay? And it just feels... And we already know that we've lost all of our constitutional protections. We already know that Congress has handed over all of their power to Javier Becerra or anybody who sits in that position. You see what I'm saying? So this is, like, if you look at each situation or each overhaul of our freedoms or whatever, then you realize that we're not what we think we are. And people are still responding to what's going on in the world right now. They're still responding to it with 20th century behavior.
Mm-hmm. Or attitudes or attitudes thought or whatever. Or thoughts. Yeah.
This is totally different. This has become, I still believe in class war, of course. That's where I begin. Clearly, you know, look at the blight that has... you know, just ravaged our once prosperous communities throughout the United States. We lived in blight for 5 years. So clearly the class war is still happening. But there's something else going on that's beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for me to articulate, but I think the military is involved somehow.
Right.
Well, I just want to pull back. Let's pull way back and look at this with a different lens. I look at it through the lens of foundations. There's an excellent book, Foundations, Their Power and Influence, because we've got foundation money and agendas that are running a sort of shadow government and have been for many, many decades. I think democracy is really... I don't think there is democracy. I think it's more like a Western facade on a film set where you ride through a town, it's the Old West, but it's just, painted facade.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did a video called, Deconstruction, and it was about the move towards global governance and how, and I don't know if this really applies to what we're talking about, but it kind of does because it moves away from the idea that, you know, you have a federal government that kind of looks over everything, and then you have states, and then, you know, you have your counties and cities, etc. You know, I don't know if our video still, like, is accurate, because we were looking at it through a different lens 4 years ago when we made it, but it basically goes down to, you know, global governance, regional, and then local. And because we were seeing that, especially during COVID, when the mayors were more powerful than their governors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The mayors of their big cities were more powerful than the states they lived in.
And so, and then you had Kamala Harris recently come out and say, like I said earlier, under my administration, you know, the big government won't be as invasive in your life anymore.
Right.
So
she's no libertarian.
No. So that basically, so this idea of, you know, what you were saying, where there's something bigger above our curated country, our country where it feels like a movie set. It's true. It always has.
A Potemkin
mm-hmm. village. Mm-hmm. It's just a facade. It goes, it's global governance or global corporate box checkers who run, who basically work for foundations and corporations are basically what's managing us. We're being managed.
Yes.
You know, we don't live under the rule of law. We live under just rules that are instituted by your managers.
Right. And
like at work.
Right.
You know?
And that comes back to that beige, boring, you know.
You're right. So the military isn't going to knock on your door and put a gun in your face and force you into a quarantine camp or anything like that.
But
instead,
right.
You're just going to get this very just kind of, you know, perfunctory message from your local community leaders who weren't really elected in. You're not exactly sure. It's like living in an HOA,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like this country is run by an HOA. We'll take all your money. And then you still have to live with dry rot all over your condo. Well,
and that front door better be green.
That's right. Yeah, right, exactly. And you can't plant those flowers out front.
Right. So.
And if you do, we'll fine you.
So this whole, I know that this was about the erosion of consciousness. And I think that it's a very simple, practical explanation to what's happening, but a lot of people try to confuse it. They try to make it bigger. They add all sorts of weird language about, you know, secret societies and all this bullshit, when really it's easier to erode your consciousness when you've got somebody with a sociology degree or a marketing degree standing there at your front door with a clipboard saying, just wanted to let you know that we're going to be shutting down the electricity and the power grid for a few hours. It'll come back up, you know, possibly in 24 hours. Thank you. Here's some information. Here's a brochure about it.
Have a nice day.
Have a nice day. You know, and we're so, like, our response mechanism is not to be combative. It's not to be confrontational. We've been taught to be polite. So we take the brochure and we say, okay, thank you for letting us know. And then we just kind of do the workarounds instead of going, whoa, whoa, whoa. I just paid like all this money to have electricity. Why are you shutting me down for that? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like that's,
and it's so
non-confrontational, and the person holding the clipboard or handing the brochure
out to you
is super nice and polite. It's not, you know,
wearing they're wearing a nice colored polo shirt.
Yeah, you know what I'm
saying? With a little insignia on it.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe a lanyard.
Yeah, a lanyard. Yeah. Yeah.
It's not jackbooted thugs. It's
just a quick story about my Aunt Betty. Last week, I was to take her to get her driver's license renewed, and I had asked her if she'd made an appointment, and she said no, she hadn't. And 2 years ago I took her and we just walked in, and so it was a walk-in with no appointment. So she said, I haven't. I said, well, we'll walk in. So we went down there, and there was a very nice gentleman with a clipboard, and he said, well, we don't do walk-ins, but if you go online at 7:45 in the morning, and he actually gave me a little piece of paper with a website address, and on it was stamped 7:45 a.m. And he said, if you go on there at 7:45 in the morning, like the magic, the witching hour, and put in all of her information from the driver's license, then you can get an appointment. And once you have that appointment, you can bring that in. They always do a few walk-ins. So the way this was conveyed from him was you've got to have the appointment first, and then once you've done that and you have the confirmation number, then you can go back and they'll squeeze you in on a walk-in. Well, I did that. I got up, was online at 7:45 the next morning, and then that afternoon I got the appointment, and the first appointment I could get online was in January of next year. So I took that and got Betty, had the confirmation number, and we went back down to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and that nice man with the clipboard wasn't there. It was a woman, and I showed her my slip, and I said, this is the confirmation number, and so we wanted to, you know, sign up for the walk-in and wait until we can get next appointment. Oh, we don't do walk-ins. I said, well, I was just here yesterday, and this fellow gave me a slip of paper that was stamped 7:45. I told her the whole thing. Well, we don't do walk-ins. So I told her the story again. Well, we don't do walk-ins. And I said, but I was told that you do a few walk-ins. And she said, well, no. She said, no, you've already explained this to me 3 times, and I've told you that we don't do walk-ins. And I said, well, I'm going to explain it a fourth time, and I'm hoping that you can come back to me instead of just saying exactly the same thing in the same way, that you can help me understand why the man yesterday said that if I did that and I got the confirmation number and I brought it, but we haven't done walk-ins in 5 or 6 years. I said, well, I was here with my Aunt Betty 2 years ago on a walk-in. Well, we don't do them anymore, so they don't do walk-ins. I think it was Millennium Winners and Losers in the Coming Age, and he talked about the age that we're going into. You'll have digital nomads, and those are people that have the right education and qualifications and digital skills that they're basically nomads. They can work from anywhere, go anywhere. And then you have a class of people that will just have more benefits. Things will be a little bit easier because they, you know, there's the haves and the have-nots in the new digital world.
I'm sort of like, I have my foot sort of 1 foot in that door and 1 foot outside of that door. I'm kind of the low echelons of those nomadic workers who have the right credentials. But like I said, I'm in the lower echelons of that. I don't, you know, I couldn't just jet off and work anywhere. I'm still kind of like stuck in two worlds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I benefit from that one world that, you know, I have the right credentials, but it's a tentative situation. It isn't like I'm in. I'm not Elon. Uh-huh. Well, I'm not like Elon Musk in many ways.
Yeah.
I don't own a mansion and a yacht. I don't know if he does, but he can buy one. And so anyway, I guess my point is that I understand exactly what you're talking about. I've known people like that. And the thing is that they're not always there. You would think that they would be wealthy. They're not always wealthy.
No.
They just have the ability to work in another way.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I think that just getting back a little bit earlier where we were, the secret societies or Freemasonic system, those have definitely been used down through time to bring about some changes. And there are societies with secrets that are involved in that, you know, revolutionary agenda. But on the lower level, you know, Freemasons who go in and are at the lowest level, they think they're involved in some great work or the great work. But what they are really getting are the kinds of perks. They do, you know, low-level things, and then they get some perks, like they don't have to wait in queues at the Department of Motor Vehicles, or they get stopped by a cop, they're not going to get a ticket.
It's a parallel society kind of situation. And, you know, you find that in a lot of situations. I mean, you know, just like cops, you know, cops are, you mentioned the police, right? So, like, you know, cops aren't going to bust other cops necessarily.
The only time we ever saw when an individual who should have had an in and should have been, like, you know, had all the privileges and all of the... you know, everything working for him, was with Donald Trump when Twitter safety took down his Twitter page. So the page, Twitter safety, back when Jack mm-hmm. Dorsey was running Twitter, took down his page. And so this was how Donald Trump was communicating with all of his followers. This is how he was, you know, pretty much influencing his voters and things like that. And all of a sudden, just like that, he was cut off with no warning. And it was very shocking when Twitter safety had more power to cut off speech than our Constitution. You know what I'm saying? Like, suddenly this... And at the time, it was run by some dweeb, you know, mm-hmm. on the back mm-hmm. end, who was told by the military to get rid of this highly influential person, which should have had all the privileges. It's easy to take down somebody like me. It's easy to, you know, I'm nobody. But so the only time we ever saw an individual that lost in the same way that regular people lose every day was when Twitter safety took down his page, when the military took down Trump.
Well, this I have pondered deeply, and I think that we're, you know, what are we looking at? Did it happen that way? Or was this the making of a persecuted hero? Both Trump and Elon Musk? You know, is this the myth-making that we're watching?
I mean, Elon Musk compares himself to Batman all the time.
Yeah.
It's like
yeah.
we're living in this childlike society
yes.
where everybody needs heroes.
Yeah.
I think my point in bringing up that example is not to lift up Trump, but to say, what the hell is wrong with us that we are allowing these digital assholes to have so much power over our speech and over our digital, you know, our digital twin. It's, you know.
I just ask myself, did it happen that way? And for the reasons that we're told, we're shown that the town square is now digitized. And if it can be taken away from somebody like Trump, then it can be taken away from us for sure. And it's dispiriting and demoralizing. Or are we rooting for Trump as the underdog? But, I mean, I think if we go back to the point that I'm making that, you know, that we haven't had democracy in a long time, then we see it a little bit differently. Or as you pointed out, Catherine Watts said, you know, the Constitution has had an end run done around it for decades.
Yeah. I mean, well, I didn't feel sympathy for the man. I felt rage towards the fact that the military has taken over the digital. I mean, all of these programs, all of them, Facebook, Twitter, ironically enough, TikTok is not part of a military program.
Yeah, it's another thing altogether.
All of them are straight out of the military. So well, to me, it's like, you know.
Well, you know, going back to like when the court cases were being, you know, when Trump was taken to court for these, you know, trumped up charges. That's a good pun. For all those charges, I think that was deliberate too. That the charges were trumped up.
Yes.
You know, it basically gave us the message that if they can do this to the former president of the United States, they can do it to you.
Right.
And that's something that we were talking about all the time during that whole period of time. And it was so shocking that, I mean, they even had me going for a little bit there. You know, I really still feel like this, because it just suddenly just disappeared. Like any of these hoaxes that they pull on us, it'll be in front of you and in front of you and in front of you and in front of you, and then it's gone.
And then I think the erosion of the consciousness, like, comes when you've got individuals in society that they're like, yeah, sure, Trump is bad, Trump is evil, we should go after him, he should be indicted. And I'm thinking to myself, but this is all just a military operation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the basics. Constitution by, gone, erased. All power is through Health and Human Services. And that comes through, and outside of that, you've got behavioral modification. So behavioral modification goes through Health and Human Services. I can't believe that so many people have lost the plot,
right.
You know, regarding...
I'm just asking the question, whose military is in control? I see this as a system that's more or less run by foundations and intelligence agencies and intelligence military operations that are way above what we are given to see. People still talk about QAnon. I mean, I was talking with someone the other day, and we were kind of seeing eye to eye on things, and it was a good conversation. And then kind of all of a sudden he said, well, you know that the military has been in charge for a long time, and we just have to trust in other words, trust the plan. So he was looking at the military as the good guys. They're in control, and they just are waiting for the right time to reveal that.
Wow.
Wow.
That's... Well, that's interesting that you say that, too, because I didn't talk to this person, but there is an individual who... He's very low on the podcast food chain. He hardly has any followers. He was taken down by YouTube. Okay. He actually just yesterday or the day before, he did a 20-minute video extolling the virtues of the former CEO of YouTube, Susan Wojcicki. I know. And this is an individual that has been right on. This individual opened my eyes to, for instance, the stories about the intubators or the ventilators killing people. And he went through great detail. He's a data analyst out of like the Boston area. And he went through, you should probably talk to him. He went through great detail about how it was actually oxygen poisoning that was killing these people, not ventilators. Mm-hmm. But because ventilators was all that we were seeing on social media, these really graphic images of people with ventilators down their throat and even cartoons of it, that we were distracted from the fact that it was so easy for someone to, with a slight cough or with a sore throat, to go into the emergency room and say, you know, I'm not feeling so great. And then they get this stupid COVID test, which says that they're positive. And then the next thing you know, they're on oxygen and they've died of oxygen poisoning. The body can only handle so much oxygen. And so they were dying of oxygen poisoning and then told it was COVID. And their loved ones were like, but I just went bicycling with him yesterday. You know what I'm saying? So he is the one that opened up all of that to me, because I was on the ventilator kick. Yeah, you know. I was really like, oh, it's the ventilators that are doing it. But then I realized that it was much more simple than that.
Yeah, it's always simple.
It's always simple and it's cheap. They're going to kill us cheaply.
That's something that we always come back to. It's like,
yeah,
look at how much money it costs to do this thing
people.
that you're saying is you know, this complicated,
right,
expensive way they're killing people. No, it's much more simple.
Yeah.
It's a lot more simple to do, you know. Yeah. So
the whole point is that I was shocked because he's a data analyst, okay? That's what he does. That's mm-hmm. what he did for mm-hmm. a living. He's really intelligent.
And yet
he actually believes in the garage.
Ah, the foundation myth.
Yeah, the foundation myth, exactly. Oh, we started our, you know, our company in the garage.
In the garage. So that he actually read that out loud. So here's this brilliant analyst just repeating New York Times talking points, and I was just shocked. So when you said that this person, that you had a conversation with this person about, you know, QAnon.
Or the military being in charge.
The military being in charge and being, you know, our heroes, it made me think of this individual and how he actually believed in the entire fabricated story about Susan
and Silicon Valley
and renting her garage to Sergey Brin and Larry Page back in the day in 1998. And golly gee, you know, it's a real rags to riches story there. You know, it's like,
yeah,
he actually believed it. And I was just really shocked because this individual should know better.
Right.
Of all the people, like, this is one person that should know better. So,
yeah. What was that sidewalk Amazon video we made?
I missed that cartoon. They don't give.
They don't offer those characters.
They don't offer those characters anymore.
So we can't make those.
So we can't make those characters anymore. They have new characters. They've upgraded their artwork or something, and I don't
it's
like
never
it as
good
much.
When they upgrade.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never.
So,
yeah.
So, but we had, and you may remember,
Sidewalk Spy Kit.
The Sidewalk Spy Kit.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had an image of Amazon dude.
Bezos.
In his garage with, you know, with, you know, Amazon poster, you know, written on the wall. You know, I don't know where I found that photo, but it was like, you gotta be kidding.
Okay, I want to do some totally wild speculation here.
Well, that's where we live, so go for it.
Alan would talk about how we cannot see or know who is at the top of the pyramid. That those we see, even the billionaires, they're the worker class. They're who we throw tomatoes at, the Soroses or the Gates, whatever. But they are the worker class. And there's also, in my mind, the idea of military versus militarized. So I see the tech class, the Bezos, Musk, Thiel, all of this as being in a tech class that is militarized.
Susan!
Susan!
All right, so someone dies and someone mourns, and so this person is mourned. by many people, but this is also a person who has sought to hamper free speech at every turn.
Actively sought to do it. She was on numerous communications with with just every across the spectrum. I mean, you just couldn't get away from it. And it's just appalling to me. And this story that I'm telling you, this is again, the erosion of consciousness. So this individual, again, brilliant data analyst, his YouTube channel was taken down by Wojcicki, okay, taken down by her policy, her YouTube policy. Mm-hmm. Is this Stockholm Syndrome? Like, he's sitting here going on.
Or was he being ironic?
Definitely. I don't think he was being ironic. He was going on and on and on and on about what a great person she was.
Wow.
And yet, it was her policy that took him down. And so this is a window into how grief and trauma can, and sentimentality can really... distort your judgment. Mm-hmm. So the one thing that the two of them have in common is they both had a child that died of a drug overdose. Mm. So he felt a kinship with her, even though she doesn't even know who he is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But if you really pick it apart, like I did recently, much to the shock of some people who think that she died of what it is they claim she died of, which is 2 years of lung cancer, I picked it apart, and her son wasn't a drug addict. He was poisoned. And I think that's what... And he died in February, and then she died March, April, May, June, July, August, 6 months later. And I think it was something else was going on, you know? You've got lawsuits against Jack Dorsey and the Biden administration for the very thing that Susan was talking about for all those years. We're going to shut down channels. We're going to shut down speech. We're going to shut down disinformation. These are our policies. We have the right to do it. I mean, she's a real hard ass about it.
Mm-hmm. But and she knew where all the bodies were buried.
And then all of these lawsuits are coming after YouTube as well. And she would have been the number one. She would have been called to testify. She would have been called to court. And she would have had to testify against Google, and she would have had to testify against the Biden administration.
Ooh, Julie.
Yeah. So, see, we're talking. And so this is what I'm saying, is that if you're so embedded in these emotional responses that are generated out through social media, and you can't get out of your own way, you lose the plot. I mean, this is a very, very dirty, dirty mob-like, mafia-like experience.
Oh, I didn't finish my speculation. I think that all of this that we are told that we're living through, this great reset, this fourth industrial revolution, this new system that we are already mostly in and going all the way into, I think it's what I see is that it's now big tech weaponized against us. And I believe that the military is that.
Right. Got it.
Got it.
Just like what people talk about, like the deep state. It's not some dudes like, you know, in back rooms, you know, with cloaks on. It's basically bureaucracy. It's the nonprofit industrial complex. Mm-hmm. It's NGOs. It's all foundations. And like you said, they're all kind of overlapping. And that's what makes up the deep state. I don't think there is any one boss. I think it's like all these things.
It's the beast.
It is the beast, yeah. Yeah, it's the blob, as some people say.
Yeah, call it, that's true.
Right?
Yeah.
The blob.
Yeah, the blob.
And the blob is the deep state. There's nobody, like, you know, plotting in the background. It's all these agendas that kind of come to fore. Now, in the very corporate way that they work, they do come into alignment with, you know, their plans so that they actually are able to pull them off. And, you know, the COVID operation was a military operation from the standpoint of it was so, like, on point. And everything was it wasn't all quite ready. They pulled the trigger too soon because they didn't have it completely refined, but they had enough of it to where they could convince, you know, a lot of people that something really bad was happening. and that they had to do something about it, like lock themselves up in their houses.
Yeah. I think that people are, in going back to what you said about how, you know, the one individual is convinced that the military is on our side and they're the good guys. They might even use the term white hats, you know, things like that. I'm like, what is with us that we've become so infantilized that we need a hero? What is going on?
Yeah.
Because people can be their own hero.
You have to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, that should be. Oh, this is something that, you know, like we live, so where we live, you know, we live we live steps from an Air Force base, believe it or not.
Right.
There's an Air Force base in Biloxi.
Yeah.
And they fly old planes, and it's a training center, so they don't, there's not jets, like, you know, screaming
right,
past
right.
us.
Right, it's not like we have jets overhead
right.
all the time.
Right, but yeah. you see a lot of military, and Julie was flying back from Pittsburgh recently, and saw a military insignia on the shoulder of a guy sitting across the aisle from her, and she thought he was here from Biloxi, but it wasn't the case at all. He was from another place. Anyway, she was talking about how the insignia had a certain look to it, and we both, or you said out loud to me, we were driving, and you said, yeah, it's weird how these military insignias look like superhero insignias.
From comic books.
From comic books. And it's like, oh my God.
It's
I thought,
true.
I was like, you're right.
Yeah, it's true.
And I'm sure that is by design. That
yeah.
is by design.
Again, the erosion of your consciousness. It's like, really, people, grow up, you know. One of the things that I know we probably have to wrap it up soon. It's been forever. JP and I recently had an experience where our credit union locked us out of our accounts for 2 weeks.
Us and every other member of the credit union.
Right. So 500,000 people were locked out of their credit
no.
union for 2 weeks. And what proceeded was a series of, like, bullshit and gaslighting from the
Ooh.
Credit union. Yeah. So basically the first thing they said through Twitter, or X, is there's an outage. So if you weren't on X and you didn't have a Twitter account, how were you to know what was going on? But I do. And so I said, well, maybe they've tweeted something. It happened on a Saturday. The Saturday before July 4th, which was a Thursday. Right? So that meant July 4th and July 5th and July 6th and July 7th. There was no access to accounts. In fact, there was no access to our accounts from June 29th until July 15th.
Oh
we
my
had
goodness.
No way of knowing where we were with our accounts. They told us there's an outage that then escalated to a cyber breach. Cyber terrorism was the reason that we were locked out of our accounts. They had to shut down our accounts. The credit union had to shut down our accounts and take away our property or access to our property for 2 weeks because of terrorism. Sound familiar? Maybe because of a virus we couldn't go to work. Maybe because of planes hitting buildings we couldn't step outside, you know, kind of thing. Once again, terrorism was used as an excuse to keep 500,000 people from their property. And I held a Twitter Spaces about this, and I invited anybody who was affected by this to join in and give their feedback. And some people were convinced it was terrorism, cyber terrorism. Some people were not. Some people were just there to try to figure out an answer. They wanted someone to lead them to an answer. And it was just a very interesting, like, social experiment. Because JP and I often look at what's happening, especially with users and the digital world, and in some cases the real world, like we're a couple of anthropologists just watching, you know, the way human behavior interacts and how much we are just so shocked by it. So what JP and I did is something that I'm convinced 498,000 people did not do. Is we took matters into our own hands, and it cost us some money, and we don't know if the outcome will work, but we called them out on their bullshit. We wrote a letter to the CEO and made sure that it was overnighted and certified, and I mean, we spent a lot of money to send it to her and said, we're calling you out on your bullshit. If it were truly cyber terrorism, then these are the things that we would have, you would have told us. Instead, your little messages on your website say, everything's fine. Be good boys and girls, and if you've overdrawn your account, you can have a loan.
Oh, because, by the way, yeah. Ooh. So go ahead.
Yes,
they allowed us access to our ATMs.
But when you went to the ATM to pull money out of your account,
it limited you.
Well, it limited us, but then the little slip of paper says no available balance. So you would get the money, but you don't know how much is left in your account.
Right.
They also told us make sure that all of your direct deposits go somewhere else. Make sure that you contact all of your debtors, like if you have your car payments or your mortgage automatically coming out of our bill pay system at the credit union, make sure you contact them and find another way to pay them. So we did. So all 500,000 members scrambled and did all of this stuff, only to find out that some people's mortgages were getting paid twice, which overdrew their account. I mean, it's a total mess.
Yeah.
People's lives are now upside down because of it.
Right.
Some people are overdrawn. Now they owe the bank money. Oh, but that's okay. The bank will give you a 4% loan. You see, this was a social experiment. This was a behavioral experiment to basically just, pardon my language, but fuck with people.
Right.
Well, with their credit.
This is something that I was going to mention earlier when we were talking about, you know, the things that we're talking about, is ultimately what is going to continue to happen or we'll see more of is that entities, organizations, the state are going to commit fraud against the people they have dominion over, whether you're a member at a credit union or you're a citizen of a given state or, you know, country or whatever, that fraud is going to be committed against you in one form or another, whether it's monetary, social, liberty, mm-hmm. whatever it might be,
yeah.
you will be, you know, they will commit fraud. And this gets back to the mundane, and that fraud can be through debt.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we talked to a host of a program, who's you know that we respect, but we told him that you know he should be paying attention to the mundane, like debt. Debt is a big issue, and debt is what's driving a lot of the economy. And mm-hmm. he just didn't get it.
Mm-mm.
But debt is one of the biggest things out there that you know people really have to worry about because that's how they get you, and
yeah.
that's how they're getting people.
Right. So now there's 500,000 people or many people who maybe accidentally overdrew their accounts and now they're in debt when they weren't before. And the reason they're in debt is because of
a situation that they didn't cause and that they were told to take action toward. And they did that. And now
they're
being punished for a situation they didn't cause in the first place. And the people who are punishing them are the ones who caused the situation.
Right. So
sound familiar?
So
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What happens to a society that is incapable of standing up and saying, I'm calling you out on your bullshit. I'm going to spend, you know, we have spent $50 to send a 3-page letter to the CEO of the credit union
and we spent a lot of time yesterday writing the letter.
Oh, all day long we wrote the letter. I was up at 2 a.m. at one point researching consumer protection law and fraud and even cyberbullying. The mm-hmm. Patelco mm-hmm. Credit Union, the credit union in question here, was bullying us through cyber messaging, whether it was on social media or emails. Mm-hmm. Also, mm-hmm. harassing phone calls. 6 phone calls a day. Harassing phone calls.
And there was no way to validate whether they were actual member, you know, representatives of the credit union or
because
not.
Because the credit union's also saying things like, watch out for spoofed calls.
Mm-hmm.
They can spoof our number, but they're mm-hmm. actually bad actors. So, anyway, I don't think that the people in... You know, I think the people in this country have been worked over, so stressed out, and it's been a slow erosion over time that if they were to try to do what we did, they'd be like, I don't want to spend 6 hours mm-hmm. writing a letter. I don't want to spend $50 to send it. I don't want to have to research all these laws. I'm too tired. I have a job to do. I have this. And I'm just like, you know, I guess I'll just drink some really strong coffee and get going, because that's that grit. And whether it works out in our favor or not, it kind of doesn't matter, because I wanted to call them out on their BS. I wanted them to know that I was onto them, you know.
Alan described the infantilization of scientific socialism, or public-private fascism. He used to say, capi, commi, fasci. It's all one system, and there's no complaints department.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if you've had a relationship with that organization or that business.
30 years credit union.
Yeah, and it's like, that doesn't matter anymore. That we discovered that during COVID. Your relationship with that given business that you had, you know, for a long time or most of your life, didn't matter anymore. It mm-hmm. went away mm-hmm. because, mm-hmm. as you said, there's no complaints department. And if there is a complaints department, we're not listening.
Right. It was like, yeah.
Recently, Elon Musk said we all need to get used to outages and, you know, power outages. And the excuse was the grid, you know, the infrastructure, the grid can't take it. But I just asked the questions, how much energy does it take to mine Bitcoin? And how much energy does it take to feed the AI beast? And just look at some of the downtime for companies that went offline for whatever reason. We're told, that an update gone bad was the excuse for one of them. But we've had these outages of huge companies that cost billions of dollars when, for whatever reason, they go offline. So we have a series of outages, and this downtime is blamed on things that may or may not be the cause.
I can't think of the name of it either.
Just for 24 hours.
But it affected Microsoft computers. Yes.
Oh, CrowdSource. CrowdStrike. This is what, and so it's interesting that you say that. Our experience with the credit union is a microcosm of what you can expect in various other, mm-hmm.
Arenas. Yeah.
I explained this to somebody who I've known for a long time and who, again, I love and respect. And they were like, well, if it's not a 9/11 type thing, then whatever. You know, they were like, I only can handle the big stuff that's in my face where it's really, really obvious. Like, mm-hmm. the COVID operation was really obvious. Kids couldn't go to school. Businesses were shut down. Suddenly behavior changed, and you had baristas acting like, you know, authoritarians making you put on a mask. I mean, that stuff was really obvious, right? And I'm like, man, it is not
like that anymore.
Mm-mm. You know,
that was the tenderizing moment.
It's the mundane. It's the mundane and the amount of energy that. So here it is, the middle of August, and we're still dealing with the fallout of what happened on June 29th with our bank. It has caused sleepless nights. It has caused him to be distracted at work a little bit. It has caused us to have to spend extra money. It has caused me to have to get up at 2 a.m. with a strong cup of coffee and research law all on my own. It has caused, you know, us to have to spend our entire Sunday writing a letter. Like, all of this stuff over the mundane, you know? And that's what people don't understand, is that it's going to take work to get through your little clipboard operators or your little, your little community advocates that are advocating for another lockdown for this particular school and that and whatever. It's, people don't want to work that
or,
hard.
Or the DMV worker who lies to your face and says, oh, we haven't done that for 5 years.
Exactly.
Well, you did this 2 years ago.
Exactly. Yes. Right.
I think consciousness tied to the mundane is important, because if you're not going to fight it, that mundane thing, whatever it is that's affecting you, if you're not going to fight that or take care of it, who is?
And also, I think it's easier for people to take to the street and hold up signs, or at least, you know, have a camaraderie with one another, even if they're not the activist type, if it's really obvious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
really difficult for people to come together. I mean, even the network of people that I've met through this Patilco experience, this credit union experience, they don't even, it's really hard for them to understand that the whole thing was a lie. And it's hard to find.
Once again, they have that feeling that it's, that there's something wrong, like it was an entire lie, but they can't process that and articulate it.
So what has happened to society that articulation and that processing is so difficult to reach when there are certain members of society like me and you that just go there automatically?
Well,
like,
you know,
was it the way we were raised? Am I just a jerk? Like, I don't know. Like,
it goes well, yeah, I know. Well,
am I cynical?
It goes back to all the things that I was talking about before, like, you know, through
the
curation through authoritarianism that's thrown at us, you know, the hyper normalization, being told two things at the same time that don't agree with each other, but they're coming from the same, you know, place. Hoaxes and lies. I mean, during COVID, we were living through a July 4th season, and we're talking like June to the end of July, of constant high grade fireworks that were being shot in a poor community, where, you know, people who yeah, sure, they might go over to Ohio and buy, you know, some pretty expensive fireworks for a day, but this was happening every night.
This was like for a month.
Yeah, for the whole
month.
And
it felt like we were under attack.
And then,
and it was babies were, you know, upset.
Pets were upset.
Animals and pets.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody in our neighborhood, you could tell, was triggered and traumatized by this constant bombarding, and it was so bad and so close to our house that I was trying to work on video essays at the time, and the sound
was
bleeding into my narration.
And
you could smell it in my house, the sulfur.
And
at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Right. And they were up on a ridge behind her house. And I even yelled at them one time, and they kind of stopped for a moment.
They stopped for a minute, and then they picked it up again. It was a military operation.
Yeah. But, you know, and then along the lines of, like, you know, the lies, right? The hoaxes and lies. So that was a hoax. But, like, they'll tell you, you know, children have always had heart attacks. They've always had heart attacks.
Yeah,
don't you know that?
Of course.
You know, and the Northern Lights have always been able, you've always been able to see the Northern Lights from Florida.
From Florida.
You know? And the solar eclipse is going to cause traffic because people are going to you clog up the roads because they have to go out and see that thing. How dare they? How dare they do that?
It's
just
so bizarre. Yeah, and history is being changed. I mean, we recently finished this 2024 new Batman cartoon.
Yeah, it's animated series.
Animated series. And it's based out of what, the 1940s?
So it's drawn and depicted in the 1940s. So it's drawn in that kind of like cool style.
Noir.
Yeah, and it's very noir.
Yeah.
But it's set in the 1940s, even though people wear seatbelts in their car.
There were no seatbelts in the 1940s.
And there's people of color in high positions. And it's normal for, you know, lesbians to meet and greet each other at a local, like,
restaurant.
Bar or restaurant that, you know, and be openly, you know,
open
about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so forth, right?
Overweight women cops were totally normal in the 1940s.
Right, right. So we were body positive. We were, you know, we were LGBT.
So you see what we're talking about.
And so
it's funny, isn't it?
It's like, I don't have a problem with any of that content. It's just that the context that they set it up in, you know, Batman has been presented in all eras, right? You can draw in that that noir style without being in the 1940s, because it's animation. You can do anything you want. the problem is that they're setting it up to make it look like it's in the 1940s, and that these things that are current in our culture were current in that culture. And so they're basically, in a very weird way, deprogramming you people and kids, I imagine, although it was kind of adult content.
Well, but you know what I'm saying.
It's like they're rewriting history, and people have a hard enough time with history in the first place. You know, they'll mix up the American Revolution with the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and this has been going along. I mean, like, go back to the movie The Sting, where, you know, you had turn of the century music being presented in the swing era. Okay. this is my point. It's like, and going back to, like, you know, even like, you know, programs where it's like set in the 18th century and you have a mixed cast, and I don't have a problem with that. But the thing is when you're presenting a show that is historical fiction, and it was written by a white author from that period of time, I'm thinking of like,
Austen,
Jane Austen, you know, all these presentations of Jane Austen stories, and they have mixed race cast. You know, again, I don't have a problem with the mixed race cast. But what I do have a problem with is that they're forcing these people into these roles that were not accurate for that story.
Yes, yes.
And, okay, that sounds like I'm a white asshole, right? But what I'm getting at is this. Why aren't we seeing stories by black authors? Mm-hmm. There's
plenty of them out there. Yeah.
And presenting the black narratives.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't we seeing the Hispanic narratives? Why aren't we we keep seeing the recycled white narratives. Oh, we're going to be open and DEI by putting people of color in these old stories that have been recycled and recycled and recycled.
I think we're
still presenting white culture.
The point is that it's year zero. It's year zero. So we can't hold on to anything that's true, and history has to be rewritten on the fly.
You know, they were bitching at us during COVID operations, saying, you know, decolonize your bookshelf. Well, you present stories by authors of color instead.
Well, okay, so one last point. Before the COVID operation, before time, JP and I did a really wonderful video essay called Expulsion. And a really wonderful high school in San Francisco has frescoes and murals painted
from the WPA era.
Gorgeous, just rich texture. And it's in a high school in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And the basically what this organization that supports black empowerment or native empowerment wanted to do was whitewash them. Just get rid of them. And a whole bunch
alumni
of that high school got together and said, no, you can't erase history. Mm-hmm. We did a video essay that was lifted up by the alumni association where we talked about, you know, and we gave all sorts of great examples of buildings and architecture that represented different cultures at the time.
Or at least,
you know,
was built by immigrant labor.
Built by immigrant labor, and how important it is to keep our history intact.
Mm-hmm.
So
even the ugly history, because here's the irony of it. It was George Washington High School, and the murals were not flattering of George Washington and his practices of
colonization
and slave ownership and
killing Indians.
Right. So,
or killing the natives, yeah.
Right. So, you know, it depicted the genocide, it depicted slavery, it depicted all these other things, but they were like, oh, we can't see slavery. People get upset when they see slavery. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so that's the problem. And that's why they wanted to whitewash these things. And so, you know, you have to look at, you know, even when history doesn't agree with you, or even when the facts of the past, you know, don't agree with your worldview, the fact is it did happen, and it had a certain effect on where we are now.
Right.
And we, you know, and like Julie said, we gave a lot of different examples of, like, you know, even like the Nazis having their art show of degenerate art.
Yeah.
And, you know, so yeah, go to the video. It's a good video.
It's 19 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. So. But anyway.
Yeah, we'll send you some things along. Julie put together a little list of some of the things.
I'm sending you the email right
now.
Okay. Adding to it. But another thing you should check out, and there's, I think, a YouTube video for it, is hypernormalization.
Yeah.
It's Curtis, Adam Curtis.
Yes.
Adam Curtis.
You've seen it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you like him, or?
I do.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
he's,
good.
Yeah. You know, we talk about no heroes, but he's kind of a media hero to us. He influenced our work a lot.
Yeah.
And that video was really important to us to help us contextualize and conceptualize, you know, a lot of things that are going on.
We use that phrase a lot.
And he's thorough, too, and you know, something we've been told we are. Julie and I were told we were lateral thinkers, meaning that we look at things from, like, all directions and put stuff together. And my work professionally as a designer is I organize things. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I appreciate his work so much, because it's so well organized. And he uses a logic that draws you through a narrative and then brings you to a conclusion that isn't his necessarily. You're allowed to draw your own conclusion. But he shows you the steps on how you get there, and he's very transparent about that. But that's what I like about him. And my AI script is still in the can because I just haven't had, you know, a moment to myself to even try to think about making it.
A move across country, working, and then just filled up with life. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's okay.
Yeah, no, I know. I know.
I think our next talk, given your backgrounds and where you've lived in San Francisco and the work that you do, I think that we should dedicate the whole talk to those militarized tech bar stewards. I think that would be a good one.
I think so, too.
Yeah,
Why not?
The tech bros.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Goodbye.
Yes. All right. Thanks. And I'll be back soon. Take care.
Got something that the world didn't give me, and the world cannot take it away. And I've got something that the world didn't give me, and the world cannot take it away. Well, it is love, sweet love, oh, sent to me from my Father.